This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Oh, you the Rock now, huh?
It doesn't matter, Booker, let the Rock say this. He knows that you and him aren't friends, but that's okay, because you have a friend. He is
gold dust.
And the Rock knows that Booker T likes gold dust very much. The Rock also knows that gold dust likes Booker T very much. Well, then,
first of all, it goes like this.
Finally, The Rock has come back to Columbus.
Trying to talk like The Rock, walk like The Rock, sound like The Rock? Well, make no mistake about it. There ain't no way, no way you could ever be the jabroni beaten. Pie-eating, trailblazing, eyebrow-raising, all-around, smack-it-down, people's champ, The Rock!
Hey, man, you ain't gotta worry about him. What you need to concern yourself with is jumping into the grill of the check cashing, sucker-trashing, never-looting, spin-a-rooting, slamming-jamming, five-time WCW champion, Booker T. You dig?
What about me?
The gold-wearing, sometimes oh-so-daring. But I'm not very good at this.
Look, man, we ain't never seen eye to eye on nothing. Probably never will. But last week on Raw, man, you got down for your crown, dog. I'm down with that.
Oh, you down with that, huh?
Yeah.
Rock, appreciate you down with that, because I meant it. Anybody who don't want to be with this company, they could get the F out.
I agree. I, too, was so down with it.
You, too, so down with it.
What's wrong with you? Stop doing that. Take my shirt off.
What?
Leave it on. You pay for that?
Yeah.
Good. Look, the fact of the matter is this. We ain't never seen eye to eye. Fine, no problem. We never will. We ain't never gonna see eye to eye. But the fact of the matter is this. The Rock is here for one reason, and that's to watch the WWE Undisputed Championship match. That's it. Undisputed Championship match. A championship that is much bigger than the People's Elbow.
Oh, yes.
A championship that is much bigger than the Spin-A-Rooney. Much bigger than the Spin-A-Rooney. And a championship that is much bigger than what do you do? What? Can't say what? What do you do? You gotta finish a move?
Oh, I have more ammunition in my cannon than you'll ever realize.
What the hell's the matter with you? Stop that. Stop rubbing yourself, man.
What?
You are. Stop that. Nobody wants to hear about your cannon. Ammunition in nobody's cannon, especially yours. You sick freak. Stop it. Even though we don't see eye to eye, we see eye to eye on something. When the time is right, you guys need to do your thing and lay it the smack it down on the NWO's candy punk asses. If you smell... Stop that. Stop it. Stop. Stop that. Okay. Stop trying to talk like The Rock, walk like The Rock. Stop wearing The Rock's t-shirt, putting a little eyebrow on, painting your hair. Stop touching yourself. Stop all that. Stop it. This is the way it goes. If you smell... What The Rock is.
The end is now.
This is gonna be a judgment day.
A cheap shot.
That's the way that you play the game.
I was blindsided.
But things will never, ever be the same.
Nice guys.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Rewind, the show where we take a look at super wrestling cards of the past and give our unique insight onto what made them special. My name is Ben Morse. You may recognize me from Place to Be Nation's main event or from This Week in Marvel. And regardless of whether you know me or whether you don't, I'm glad you're here and I'm glad you're listening. Tonight we are going to be looking at King of the Ring 2002. A very interesting show, and a show I picked for a reason. But before we get to that reason, let's introduce the other part of the two-man booth tonight. You may have known him from the WrestleMania Top 10 series that he did during WrestleMania season. He's a newer contributor to Place to Be Nation, and we're excited to have this be his inaugural show. We are going to take his podcast virginity and run with it. Stephen Ferrari, welcome to PPBN Rewind.
How's it going, Ben? Glad to be here. This is my PTBN podcast virginity that you're popping. I've done podcasts before. This is just the first time, for this site, which is, I'm really happy to be here.
Well, there ain't no podcast like a PTN podcast, because PTN podcast sometimes starts on time. but regardless, man, happy to have you. And like I said, we're talking about King of the Ring 2002 tonight. Now, the reason for this is, as we all know, recently the WWE announced that they're going to be going back to a brand extension. They're going to go back to Raw and SmackDown being two distinct separate shows. Are you excited about this, Stephen, or are you a little apprehensive?
I'm very apprehensive because really? I just don't see how they're going to get away with it. They have a good sized roster right now, mm-hmm. but it's not anywhere near the size that it was in 2002 when they did the original split. Unless you count the guys down in Flat Full Sail for NXT, but that introduces a whole other set of problems.
Well, they certainly have said they're going to be going out there recruiting a little more aggressively. We've seen them sign some top Japanese names. They're bringing in these guys for the cruiserweight show. But I think you make a very valid point. The roster as it is right now, can it support two shows? I've always been a big proponent of the brand split. I think having SmackDown there enables you to build stars who may not be ready on Raw or may not get the chance. You know, you look at guys like Rey Mysterio, Eddie Guerrero, Edge, all guys who benefited from being on SmackDown, JBL. These guys all became stars because they were able to shine outside of the glaring light of Raw. But if you don't have enough guys, you don't have enough guys, and that's the long and short of it.
And I think that you're going to see a bunch of people thrive in this environment. Don't get mm-hmm. me wrong. I think you're going to have, you know, your Cesaros and your Kevin Owens get to even higher heights than they would have that without the brand split. But they are. I remember when they originally did this back in 2002. I didn't have the UPN, so mm-hmm. there's no way for me to see SmackDown.
So, the problem there is resolved because they're all on USA now.
That's true, and that's definitely a better way. That it's definitely better now than it was then, but it's still 5 hours of wrestling.
True.
Back to back.
Yeah.
It's not like you have 3 days off. You know.
Yeah.
Before a show comes on, it's Monday night for 3 hours. It's SmackDown for 2 hours, and once a month you're gonna have the pay per view for that's another 3 hours. NXT on Wednesday, there's another hour. I mean, at some point you're going to hit a saturation level, and that's what really concerns me.
We're cursed with too much wrestling to watch.
No, I know. It's a terrible thing.
There are worse ways to go.
First world problems.
You know, now I want to get into the show we're discussing in just a sec. Before we go, let's talk about this too. Another great thing about the brand extension is it does create some form of competition within the company, which, you know, is a good thing. You know, NXT has been pushing the main roster to be a little bit better in the past year or so. Do you think this is another opportunity for SmackDown and Raw to kind of go at it and, as a result, both get better?
I hope that they have a similar attitude towards the brand split as they did in the beginning of the original one, where they're mm-hmm. really pumping up both shows. You had originally the SmackDown 6 that really helped to give SmackDown an identity back then. And if they can find a way to do that now, I think we're in for a lot of good shows. you know, it's I'm curious to see where they go with the roster split.
Yep, definitely. There's a lot of questions that need to be answered. I think a lot of good points made here. But we are casting our eyes back, 14 years.
Oh, man. 14
years to 2002, King of the Ring. The reason we picked this show was because it was also taking place in the midst of a brand split that was still new. It was only a couple months old at this point. The draft lottery had happened. Backlash and Judgment Day had already occurred.
But this was, and they had just recently gotten the F out.
They had just recently gotten the F out. This is the second WWE pay-per-view as opposed to WWF. Very good point. Very astute, Steven. But it was the first of the major pay-per-views to showcase SmackDown and Raw and actually have some SmackDown versus Raw matches. Now, does the brand split play a huge role in the show? That's something we're going to keep an eye on as we go through it. But it was just, you know, a nice way to select a fun show to watch. I haven't seen in a while. Now, Steven, where were you at King of the Ring 2002? Were you watching regularly? Were you taking a break? What was your status as a fan?
I had just gotten out of college, which while I was in college, it was very hard to, I didn't have a television.
Mm-hmm.
So my watching was very sporadic, but having just graduated, moved into a new apartment, I just started to rewatch or get right back into it. So I was watching Raw every week. Again, I had no UPN, so no SmackDown. So I was missing out on a bunch of guys. But I was just starting to get back into things. This is the first, King of the Ring 2002 was probably the first show that I watched live since I left for college.
Oh, very cool.
And I watched it at a Hooters in Syracuse. So I don't remember if I had all the sound, if the show was being broadcast with the sound and everything, or if it was just on the TVs. But I remember I remember specifically going to a Hooters in Syracuse to watch the show.
Now, you went to the Hooters just to watch wrestling?
Yes.
That was it.
That's all I'm admitting to. With my wife in the same room.
We'll take your word for it, Steven. I was still in college at this point, and I actually had the reverse problem of you. I got UPN so I could watch SmackDown, but my college didn't have the was it Spike TV yet, or was it still TNN at this point that had Raw?
I think it was still TNN.
Yeah, so we didn't get TNN, so I couldn't see Raw. So right off the bat, you and me going down brand loyalty lines. I could see SmackDown. You could see Raw. Between the two of us, we could see it all. But yeah, I don't think I watched King of the Ring 2002 live. I definitely saw it at some point because I remember these matches. But it was not too fresh in my mind as I came to the rewatch here. So
I hadn't seen this show since I watched it at Hooters when I watched it again just a couple days ago.
All right. Well, I hope your experience in your home or wherever you watched it, your Hooters. Did you go back to another Hooters to watch it?
No. I don't even know where there is one near me.
Good answer.
Those still exist?
Oh, yeah. Still open? Oh, Hooters. Listen, man. I live in New Jersey. I definitely see them. There's plenty.
I know that there's one in Wayne. I have a cousin who goes there all the time.
Yeah. They're like Starbucks here. One on every corner. But that's cool. Let's get into the show. Let's talk about it. And one of the first major things was this was different from the other King of the Rings in that the winner of this King of the Ring tournament, unlike some past winners, was going to get a very special gift. He was going to get a shot at the WWE Undisputed title at SummerSlam. So one of the four men entered in the King of the Ring remaining here was going to be challenging for the title at SummerSlam. Do you feel like this added something that the King of the Ring needed, or was it fine just on its own?
I think it's a perfect stipulation for the King of the Ring. I think it's something that they should have done from the beginning, despite the fact that two of the first three winners went on to SummerSlam to fight for the title.
Yep, that's true.
It wasn't an actual stipulation for it. It should have been, because I think it would have given a little bit more weight to the show. Here, I think it made it very obvious who was winning.
Yep. That is one thing you can argue against. I think it's something that, you know, the Royal Rumble's come under heat for having, there's only so many guys can win it here. King of the Ring maybe narrowed the field. That's a good point. Let's look at the matches that, because the first two matches we have are two King of the Ring semifinals. And the first match out the gate, Rob Van Dam against Chris Jericho. RVD has been in WWE for about a year at this point. Jericho, about 2 years or three. And they're both, you know, working similar styles, very high energy, lots of reversals, lots of flying, lots of botched spots. But this was a pretty good match. It was fun. It was fast-paced. I thought they did a good job of it. We talk a lot here on PTV on Rewind about the idea of the opening match, what the opening match needs to have to set it apart from the rest of the show, what it needs to get started. What do you look for when you look for a quality opening match, Stephen?
I just, you want the energy. You want to get the crowd going. You want to get the crowd really excited. And, you know, whether it be with high spots or a good tag match, you know, that's what the opening match needs to do. And I think that RVD and Jericho did a great job. Mm-hmm. It was a perfect choice, I thought, given the rest of the card. It was the perfect match to kick the show off.
Now, these guys both came from outside WWE. They had vast experience elsewhere. RVD, obviously, mostly in ECW. Chris Jericho, an international star. Jericho, at this point, had pretty much acclimated to WWE style. I mean, the guy was a veteran in WWE. He had been the Undisputed Champion. He knew how to work a WWE-style match. Van Dam, a year into his tenure, do you think he was starting to get it, or was he still working the kinks out of being more of an ECW guy, because certainly that was a different environment to work in?
I think having just rewatched this, I think he finally was starting to get it. I think he was finally starting to get to the point where he was working a style specifically for the WWE. You know, and that certainly wasn't true for a good chunk of his first year.
Yeah.
And maybe it was working with Jericho.
Oh, they're pissing off.
I mean, you know, the guy knows what he's doing when he's in the ring. He's a quote-unquote ring general. You know, so maybe he was able to guide RVD into a good match. But as it was right here, it was just a perfect example of what a good opening WWE match should be.
Yeah. Jericho ends up laying down. RVD does get the win with a 5-star frog splash. Gets to show off, gets to be on top. They both got a lot of stuff in on this match. Now, I want to ask you, really? Stephen, a couple months prior to this at WrestleMania, Jericho was the Undisputed Champion. Now he's losing in the opening match. On the flip side, Rob Van Dam, Intercontinental Champion, seems to have everything going his way. What would you say was the relative value of both of these guys to the promotion in June of 2002?
I think what I said earlier about Jericho was his value, was just getting these guys. I mean, now that you have, when you have this brand split, you're having a lot of newer guys come up and giving some more airtime to a lot of new people. Having Jericho there to kind of lead the way and help them get acclimated into the show is his best role, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. Yeah, totally. I mean, it's a role he's still playing today. He was a young veteran there. He is a slightly older veteran now, and he's great at working with young guys and putting them over, very unselfish, and kind of introducing them to the WWE audience. I agree completely.
As far as RVD goes, I don't know what they saw in him. I think he could have been a world champion sooner than he eventually ended up being. What was that, in 2006 he finally
2006,
won the title?
So we're still 4 years out from that here.
But, obviously there was something about him that they didn't trust. I think that became very apparent when he did win the world title. He's a guy, he's high energy. He's for a relatively chill, you know, guy. His matches are high energy, and he gets the crowd into it. And you know, like an opening match guy to get the crowd going is not a bad place to be.
No, absolutely not. I think RVD was an interesting case. He was a guy who was red hot in 2001. who could have, by all accounts, been the face of WWE if they wanted him to be. They just chose, like you said, for various reasons, never to make him the guy. He was always, you know, well-regarded, always intercontinental champion, picked up big wins, did pretty well, but he never quite got to the top. And we can talk more about that when we get later in the card and how RVD's used on this particular night.
Yeah.
But we have another semifinal match to talk about. This one's a little odder. Rob Van Dam and Jericho, that totally sounds right. Sounds like two guys could be great kings of the ring, both on the same level, definitely competing against each other. On the other side, you have Brock Lesnar, the next big thing, about 2 months into his WWE career, clearly on the verge of huge things. And then you have Test, who had kind of been meandering in the mid-card, hadn't really done a whole lot, you know, a lot of tag matches, not a lot of showcase on pay-per-view. It was perpetually built, a guy who could always be a threat, but this seemed a little lopsided. Would you agree, Steven?
That was my impression when the match started. I had no recollection of this at all coming into it. So the whole, like, starting the show and seeing where everything was and how we were set up, I was just, I even questioned, like, really? Test? Because, you know, his peak came 2 years before this with the Stephanie McMahon angle.
Right.
And that was it. Like, after that, it was just like this downward spiral where he just kind of leveled off, where he could have been a main eventer. And then it was just like, you know what? Nah, we're done with you. And he just stayed in the mid-card for the rest of his time. And I watching this match was made by Paul Heyman on the outside, personally. I would not believe Test is a threat to Brock Lesnar, but Paul, as Brock Lesnar's manager, sold it to the point where it became credible to me.
That's interesting.
Just watching him, just watching him react when Test went for a near fall was just, it was a thing of beauty.
So you think Paul Heyman alone kind of sold you on Test being a threat to Brock Lesnar?
Yes. In fact, that was one of the things, that was one of the things that I wrote in my notes as I was taking this. Like, it's just that Heyman helped to sell a Test near fall better than Test did.
I got to tell you, I number one, I agree with you, but number two, I've really come to appreciate Test more as I've gone back and watched, not because he was a guy who should have been world champion. You know, like you said, maybe he did have that shot back during when he was during the Stephanie McMahon angle when he was at his hottest. Sure, he could have done well, but just as a guy who was a credible power wrestler who could get in there and have decent matches with people. And I did think this was a decent match. It wasn't bad. And
no, it certainly wasn't bad.
It wasn't bad. And what I'm interested there is, how much do you credit to Test, who is, strangely enough, the veteran in this scenario, or do you just give it to Brock Lesnar, who, despite, like I said, only being 2 months into his WWE career, man, the guy looked like a natural.
It was clear from day one that Brock Lesnar got it. He had it from the minute that he stepped into the ring for the first time.
Right.
I don't know that, like, you know, Ric Flair's fond of saying that it takes two to tango in there, and I think this is probably the best example of that. I think that they both needed to trust what they were doing, and they just went at it in a hoss situation where they just beat the hell out of each other.
Yeah, they certainly did. The one interesting thing here is you've got two heels. We had in the last match, we had a clear heel, Jericho, clear face, Rob Van Dam. Does having the heel go against the heel hurt this match at all, or was it a non-factor?
It was a non-factor because just like now, Brock Lesnar wasn't a heel. I mean, he was supposed to be the heel. He was supposed to be booed. But nobody was booing this guy. I mean, it was just kind of like just the natural charisma that he had and the natural charisma that Paul Heyman had. To me, I wasn't booing it.
Right.
I was a big fan right off the bat. I think that there were a lot of people who were the same way, and they were just totally into this guy.
Yeah.
So he might have been booked as and supposed to be the heel, but that wasn't how the fans treated him, and that how wasn't how he was treated overall, I don't think.
I agree, and I think it wasn't so much do we hate him, do we love him, it was more just a fascination. We're fascinated by this guy. What is he? How can he be so big and move like that? How can he be so natural in the ring? And no surprise here, Brock wins with a nice-looking F5. Test gives him a good little match, and we have our finals. It's Brock Lesnar against Rob Van Dam. Now, at this point, you still are thinking, once you have that finals in place, you're still thinking it's an open book?
I'm sorry?
You're still thinking you know exactly who's going to win. I'm asking you to cast yourself back to that Hooters in 2002. Once the finals was laid out, you still knew what you knew it was going down.
I don't think my opinion changed at all from the minute that the show started. It was clear who was winning that title shot.
Fair enough. We will get back to the King of the Ring tournament in a little bit. We had some other business to take care of. First little business backstage where Bubba Ray Dudley gets interviewed on the Raw side. Lance Storm and Christian get interviewed on the SmackDown side. We get to see kind of the insurgents of the Un-Americans. What did you think of the backstage personalities being displayed, Steven?
Bubba Ray was still obviously working out the kinks.
Yeah.
He couldn't be the ECW Bubba, and he definitely hadn't gotten to the point where, it was the TNA Bully Ray stuff. So that was just kind of whatever, but the Un-American stuff, those guys were always great.
Mm-hmm. They were definitely the whole over-the-top American conspiracy.
Yeah.
We've got to take care of this. It was great with Storm as, the ultimate straight man. I agree. They shined right away. Now, the other thing that was going on during this little in-between segment is we shoot up to Michael Cole and Taz, who are not commentating on the show, which I didn't remember that SummerSlam was the first show where they got to have their own commentary. Do you think it took away from the card that the SmackDown matches were not trusted to be called by the SmackDown announcers?
Not really.
Hmm.
I mean, if it was today,
yeah,
that would definitely be the case. But it was JR and the King doing commentary. I mean, if you can't trust them to do the whole show, you've got a problem. And I think Cole and Taz were good as kind of like the analyst's role. Like just kind of, talking a little bit about what's going on before, in between matches.
I think this was the very early period where you could get away with it. But very quickly, Cole and Taz and, Justin and Scott have talked a lot about this on the Place to Be podcast, how Cole and Taz grew into a great role as kind of the more legitimate sports announcers. And even by SummerSlam, when you had Brock Lesnar really emerging as a force and really the SmackDown 6, who you mentioned earlier, starting to come out, I think you put this show later in the summer even, definitely by the fall, you really want the SmackDown guys calling the SmackDown matches. But I will agree with you, at this point it was still early on enough that it still all seemed the same. JR and the King were having a pretty good night, so they were good.
Yeah. I don't think that you had there weren't enough matches that required Cole and Taz's style.
Mm-hmm.
I think as a later split shows would do.
Fair enough.
JR and King really fit better, I think, with what they were doing. There's a couple matches going, at least one match later on, that probably should have been, it would have legitimately been a SmackDown announced match, and I just can't imagine Cole and Taz doing.
Interesting. Now, did you think the SmackDown versus Raw of it all, the rivalry between the two brands, did that show on this card, or was it kind
they
of
were
forgotten?
Trying?
Yeah.
They were definitely trying. I don't think that they pulled it off the way that they wanted to, but they were trying.
Fair enough. So we transition from there into possibly one of the matches you were describing, because this is a Cruiserweight title match. Cruiserweight's exclusive to SmackDown.
Yeah.
It all started when Nydia the winner of Tough Enough, who had been portrayed as, you know, kind of a shy, nice girl on Tough Enough. So they right away decide, you know what, you're going to be the nymphomaniac from the trailer park. I would love to have sat in on the meeting where Vince or whoever pitched Nitty on this, because I just remember I was a big fan of Tough Enough. I was like, really? That's Nitty's role? She didn't seem like she was in a trailer park. She didn't really seem like she was too outgoing, but you know what? We'll take it. We'll run with it. She debuted as an ex-girlfriend of the Hurricane being Gregory Helms, who was the Cruiserweight champion at the time. She brought in Jamie Noble, former WCW talent, as her new boyfriend, and a feud was born. What did you think of this match, the Cruiser? It's not the typical Cruiserweight match necessarily, because Hurricane is not so much a typical Cruiserweight, doesn't fly as much as the other guys, and neither does Noble. But yeah. I got to say, I enjoyed this match, and I thought Noble, for a guy who is coming into WWE on a major, like a fairly major part on a pay-per-view, and this is one of his first matches, he seemed pretty natural.
Oh, he seemed very comfortable. And I think a lot of that had to do with his opponent. Because correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty sure Noble and Helms were in the ring with each other a few times in WCW. Yep.
Yeah, they, so, before there was the SmackDown 6, there was Three Count and the Young Dragons. They were six guys who went around and around and had great matches with each other. Some of the highlights of me and Andrew Reich have talked about on some of the past episodes of PDM Rewind, how we have a guilty soft spot for that last year of WCW, and these guys were certainly a big part of it.
Oh, those Cruiserweight matches with Three Count and the Young Dragons were phenomenal.
Yep.
They were some of the best matches that WCW had in its later years. So that was a brilliant move, really, by WWE, bringing in Noble and putting him up against Helms.
Mm-hmm.
Just to get that level, and it's the same thing as putting somebody in the ring with Jericho. You want to get their comfort level going. And I think that really introduced Noble into the show, gave them an opportunity to put on a good match against two guys that trusted each other, and really just impressed the hell out of everybody.
Now, it's interesting you point that out, basically saying, you know, they could trust Hurricane to have a good match, because Hurricane, for so much of his career, was a comedy character. But there are certain instances like this match where it's required of him to be serious. Now, I'm not talking about Sugar Shane Helms or Gregory Helms. When he doesn't have the mask, he can be serious. But this is one of the rare instances where you see a very serious, credible threat Hurricane match during the early parts. How did you think he pulled that off? I always think he rose to the occasion very nicely, but was it odd to you seeing him in there, you know, serious, trying to,
a little bit, because
doesn't
the most,
look quite right.
Because mostly what I remember of Hurricane is just the comedy guy, you know, the leading Rosie around as a superhero in training, you know, stuff like that. But you're right, like, looking back on it, he had the opportunity every now and then to just do really great work.
Yeah.
And this is probably one of the first ones in that time frame of the Hurricane where he just shined. And it's kind of surprising that going forward they just kept him in that comedy role when he's proving himself as somebody who could go.
It was an interesting dichotomy because he is someone who obviously could go as a serious wrestler, probably could have been a decent mid-level intercontinental title kind of guy. But then the character's so good, too. He was almost, he almost was his own worst enemy in the sense that he was really good at playing a comedy character.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a place for that on the show. There was a place for him to perform well. But, you know, it's like he was so good at the comedy that they didn't take him out well enough. I mean, again, our buddies Justin and Scott are seeing him in 2006 right now, where he has kind of his renaissance as Gregory Helms. But him and Noble both, I mean, they were great characters, but they were also great workers, and that puts you in an interesting conundrum with WWE.
I don't think I ever really got Jamie Noble as a character back then. Like, it just... that's probably just personal preference. The guy was great in the ring, especially against certain people. But just the whole like the whole white trash thing with Jamie Noble and Nydia. And maybe I just couldn't, because I wasn't watching SmackDown at the time either.
Yeah.
So I would only see him on very rare occasions.
That's true.
But for me, like, Jamie Noble's best work has been with as one of Seth Rollins' toadies in the last couple of years.
He was great in that. I think a lot of the stuff he did with Nydia was, I don't want to say it's underrated, but like you said, you didn't get to see SmackDown. They did some vignettes that, like, they really threw themselves all into it. You know, just them going out with the Cruiserweight title, buying an extra wide trailer so they could have, you know, they could make out and be all gross. They were a guilty pleasure for me. I think they were a guilty pleasure for a lot of people. What did you, because she was such a factor in the match, what did you think of Nydia? Was she well cast in this role? Was there a way she could have maybe had longer term success if she'd been more of a straight women's wrestler? What did you think?
Oh, certainly. I think her character killed her.
Okay.
Because she did it so well.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're finding here, especially within this one match, especially, that once you get cast in a role like that, once you do it so well, you know, some people just can't see you outside of that.
Mm-hmm.
The women who were successful in the early part of the 2000s transcended a character. And, you know, Nydia was just the white trash girl.
Yeah.
I mean, she did it. She did it perfectly. She added the exact whatever was needed to this match. She added it perfectly. But I think it was just kind of like a death knell for any kind of future success.
Well said. Jamie Noble walks out of this match with the Cruiserweight title. It's a fun match. If you guys are rewatching the show or looking for something to rewatch from the show, it's definitely one of the matches I would suggest. But we move on to a match between two guys who are definitely legends. At this point in their career, they were already establishing great legends, but now it's two Hall of Famers, and that's Ric Flair and Eddie Guerrero. And that was interesting because Flair had come back into the then WWF towards the end of 2001 as the owner of Raw, well, as one of the co-owners of the whole company. When the brand split went down, he was the owner of Raw. He turned heel. He feuded with Steve Austin. He actually had Eddie Guerrero and Chris Benoit as kind of his lieutenants. And then Steve Austin left the company. Flair lost control of Raw, turned babyface, became an active wrestler again, and is going up against Eddie here as Eddie and Benoit blaming Flair as being the reason that Austin left. Now, did you think Flair, who'd been pretty effective as this figurehead who would occasionally have matches, he had said, you know, I have one last run in me. Was that the best use of Flair at this point? Was that as an active wrestler? And granted, again, this is 2002. Obviously, we know he would go much longer, but kind of trying to cast yourself back there. Did you think this was the best use of Ric Flair?
No, I don't think that I did. Trying to remember back in time.
I'm with you. So I'm with
he
you.
Was, but he was vastly proving me wrong. Especially with, you know, when he had that, he had 2002 was the year he had the match with The Undertaker at WrestleMania, right?
Yep. Great match.
And, you know, I think he's been on record saying that that was kind of the match that brought him back and gave him back his confidence, and you could see why. But still, you know, at this point, it was like, all right, WCW's dead. It's time to, like, I was happy to see Flair back in WWE, but wrestling regularly, you know, like, I thought that his value was much more as a figurehead, an on-screen character, as opposed to a wrestler. And, you know, I don't like admitting that I'm wrong, but I was definitely wrong there, because the match that he had with Eddie Guerrero was one of my favorites of the show.
Yeah, it was a great match, to be sure. I mean, when these two guys are in there, they had matches back in WCW. They knew each other, but this was a more solid, to talk about the guy on the other side, this is a more solid Eddie Guerrero. This was in the midst of his big comeback. He had been less than a year earlier fired for basically not being able to kick the habits of drugs and alcohol. Mm-hmm. he had come back strong in the spring. He was clean for the first time in a long time. Had a great series with Rob Van Dam. Eddie Guerrero was primed to have a great run here. And I don't know. I enjoyed this match too, as you did, but I had some of the similar feelings of Flair being a guy I was ready to see become an on-screen character, less of a wrestler. I thought he had a lot to add just with promos and just with stuff like that. I wasn't really itching to see him get back. I understand they were in a tight spot, but boy, you talk about doing the best you can with what you're given. This is a tremendous match.
It was a great match, and it's one of the rare occasions where you have a kind of an overbooked ending that didn't take away from everything, and that gives a lot of credit to the people who were involved. Now, I'm going to admit that I have no recollection of why Bubba Ray Dudley interfered in the match at the end. Just complete blank spot to me.
It didn't really go anywhere. I think it was basically implied. I mean, he said earlier in the show he was going
to try to make an impact.
Trying to make an impact, and that was interfering in this match. All it led to was there was a quick Dudley Boys 2.0 with Bubba and Spike versus Benoit and Eddie feud. It lasted about a month. It didn't do too much. I think they were throwing a lot of stuff at the wall with Bubba. They really knew he had something. And like you said earlier, you nailed it earlier when you said he would eventually, over a decade later, realize it in TNA as Bully Ray, that he had this kick-ass singles run inside of him. But I think they were just trying to shake him loose then and try anything to try to get that out of him in 2002.
If there was ever a part of the brand split that I shook my head at and just did not know what they were doing, it was splitting up the Dudley Boys.
Mm-hmm.
Because they just went nowhere.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, like, it's great that they managed to kind of elevate Spike a little bit by teaming with Bubba, and Reverend Devon got to have some big, huge bodyguard that eventually went on to win the world title.
Yeah.
But It was just terrible for them, I think, personally, because they were a team. Nobody saw them as anything but a team. I don't know that I had ever seen Devon wrestle out without Bubba before the brand split.
Yeah, I think you'd have to go all the way back to ECW to see that.
And
those were vastly different matches.
Yeah, I mean, the first recollection that I have of Devon was when he was with Bubba as the Dudleys in ECW. Anything before that is just, I've never seen it.
Yeah.
Oh.
Well, they were trying to make something work here with Bubba Ray. He cost Eddie Guerrero the match. Flair ends up getting the win. Did that bother you at all, Eddie, having to job here, or did the circumstances kind of excuse it?
If I had remembered the circumstances leading into the tag teams with Spike and Benoit and Guerrero, it probably would have bothered me less.
Mm-hmm.
I think that overall it was fine because it did. I guess it did lead into something.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that Eddie probably should have won that one.
Yeah. In retrospect, yeah. But Eddie would go on to do okay for himself. Flair would go on to do okay for himself. And don't spend any time tonight worrying about either of these guys.
Just think of had they gone in the opposite direction of what you could have had, what Ric Flair could have taken out of Bubba Ray had he attacked Ric Flair.
Oh, that's really interesting to think. Yeah, Flair Bubba Ray feud. I think that would have been a great place for Bubba Ray to find his character.
And I mean, I think that you would have seen Bully Ray 10 years earlier.
That's a bold statement, but I like it. And that's also to say that, you know, what we got here was not the original plan. This was supposed to be Eddie Guerrero against Steve Austin, arguably the run that would have made Eddie a main event player a few years ahead of when he did, and who knows what we had then, but it's funny the way things play out.
It probably worked out for the best.
It worked out okay. Next match, and one more match before we hit the break. Let's talk about Trish Stratus defending the women's title against Molly Holly. And This was a transitional time for the women's division. Trish Stratus had been given the women's championship when she was still relatively unproven in ring. At this point, she has been through her series with Jazz. She's gone up against some veteran competitors. She's really starting to put things together. Molly Holly is a new gimmick. We'll talk a little bit about her gimmick in a sec, but you know, the basic trappings of it was she was the virginal girl who wanted to bring class back to the women's division. But these two could both really go bell to bell. What did you think of the match itself, Steve?
This match did not feature the Trish Stratus that everybody remembers. She's still learning.
Right.
And she had grown leaps and bounds from the previous 2 years when she had been in there. But she was still kind of working into that point of being the Hall of Fame women's champion, Trish Stratus. Having said that, though, she had a great match with Molly. I saw it. I really like both of these, both of them in the women's division. I thought that they always had a lot of, good matches. This is one of the things that bothered me, though, listening to the commentary, especially with JR making a couple of knocks against Molly's weight, which again, you know, just stuff like that always bothered me. Mm-hmm. And I don't really remember a lot of where that came from. I may have just blocked it out of my head. And watching her go, you know, she's a hell of an athlete.
Yeah.
I think she and Trish had a great match. But the commentary just bothered the hell out of me.
Yeah, this was one spot where, I mean, you know, how much do you really blame the commentators? How much do you blame the person talking in their ear?
The person talking in their ear.
But it definitely, it weighed down what was a pretty good match with the fact that the commentators were not talking about the match at all. They were talking about Molly's weight, which obviously she looked like a perfectly normal, healthy woman.
Right.
And I think, to our credit, most wrestling fans got that. I don't think the Molly Holly is a fat ass was a thing that really caught on even amongst the most ardent wrestling fans. I think people saw right through it and obviously didn't stay for very long. The virgin character was more interesting because that you could really contrast to, you know, these girls who are going out there and wearing next to nothing. That was an interesting gimmick. But I did think this is the one spot where I would have liked to have seen a different announce team. I don't recall Cole and Taz, definitely in their early days, getting kind of browbeaten into the point where they were making fun of Diva's weights or anything like that. It just felt that was a thing that worked for Lawler's character.
Yeah,
they pushed it.
And I think in 2002, it would have been really weird hearing Cole or Taz make fun of the women, instead of actually just calling it and taking it seriously.
Yeah.
This is definitely the one match where I would have rather have told Taz and Cole call over the other two. For some reason, I really could not say Taz and Cole there before, and just got tongue tied like all hell.
It's okay.
And that's probably the biggest black mark on this show is the commentary for this match.
The
match itself,
you,
not bad.
Good match.
Commentary was terrible.
Molly Holly wins her first women's title. It's an interesting match. They go pretty hard at each other. Molly is one of the most underrated female competitors of the Attitude Era.
Definitely.
She kind of slipped in and out. She got a few title reigns there, but not as well remembered. So another match that's definitely worth going back and checking out. So about halfway through the show, we'll take our break. But Stephen, what are your impressions so far of King of the Ring 2002?
It's a thumbs up. Right through now, it's been an enjoyable show.
Cool. We got three more matches to talk about, but first we're going to give you guys a chance to hear from all the other great podcasts we've got here at the Place to Be Nation family. My name is Ben Morris. We're talking King of the Ring 2002 here on PTBN Rewind, and we will be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly. Make sure you check out every episode of The Kevin Kelly Show right here on the Place to Be Nation. PlaceToBeNation.com, The Kevin Kelly Show, every episode is a winner. At least we hope.
Placement Nation's Justin Rosero here. In addition to the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes and PlacementNation.com. You can check out Scott Criscullo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Main Event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. And relive wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series, led by Ben Morse, and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. We got sports covered too with the Sports Evolution Mega Show with Scott, Dr. G, Cowboy, and Cowboy Sr., the Kings of Sport led by Live Audio Wrestling's godfather Nate Milton, as well as the NBA Team Podcast and the TJ McClune Show. PTBN tackles pop culture and irreverence with Richard and the Mailman, the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, and if you like a hybrid of all of this in list form, check out Jordan Duncan's Rank and File. All of these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. We want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keats' Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the reaction shows with good old Will from Texas. We got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
All right, everyone, we're back. Hope you got some more great suggestions of podcasts to listen to, whether it's wrestling, comics, movies, TV, anything you need, you can find it at placetobenation.com, including great chance to go to Amazon, great chance to do all the other things that benefit our wonderful website overlords. Am I doing that right, Steven? Did I do the plugs there okay?
I think that was good.
Perfect, perfect.
Yeah. The Place to Be Nation podcasts are in regular rotation as I take my subway ride to work, to and from work every day.
The same. I am always listening to Place to Be Nation podcasts, and so should you. It'll make you a better person. Speaking of better people, let's get into our next match. A big match between two big names, Hulk Hogan, Kurt Angle, meeting up for the first time. This is during Hulk Hogan's return to WWE, his triumphant return after WrestleMania 18 with The Rock, back in the red and yellow, back playing the ultimate babyface. Kurt Angle had just lost his hair to Edge in a hair versus hair match the month before, was still clinging to the idea that he had hair by wearing a poor wig underneath the wrestling headgear. Hogan took offense at that, said, if you're bald, you're bald. They had a lot of fun. It was kind of a fun build-up to this match. My question for you, Steven, is did you see this as a dream match? Did Kurt Angle have enough tenure at this point that you wanted to see him? If Hogan could only wrestle so many guys, is one of the people you wanted to see him wrestle Kurt Angle? And I don't have my own answer, but I want to hear yours first.
I don't think I ever would have thought it.
Yeah.
Until it happened. It was one of those things that I didn't know I wanted until I saw it.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you.
Until it came up, it was like, it just never occurred to me. And then it did. And then it was like, holy crap, this is amazing.
It really is. I mean, this is just, it's two American icons. Their characters play off each other so well. Even when it's, what's the best way to describe it? When they both went big, because they both are such outsized characters, when Angle went over the top, when Hogan went over the top, it just felt like these were the right opponents for them to have. I mean, Hogan had just wrestled Undertaker the month before. It had been kind of underwhelming. Angle, on the other hand, had a great feud with Edge, but it just seemed like a great intersection to have this legendary figure and this guy who is still very much on the rise, forming his own legend. I loved this match. It was not
the most technically sound match on the card.
No, by no, any not means. At all.
But it was just so much fun to watch these guys clearly having a blast. And I don't think it's a different energy than Rock Hogan or a lot of the stuff Hogan did, because Angle, or even Triple H Hogan, because Angle was not, you know, the guy who had been a pro wrestling fan all his life getting to wrestle his hero. He was a legit athlete kind of stuck in there with the embodiment of pro wrestling. And I think that's what I loved about it.
I thought that, first of all, Kurt Angle in a wig is one of my favorite Kurt Angle memories. Because he pulled that off amazingly. The problem that I think the reason, though, that I didn't see this as like a dream match was, despite the fact that Kurt Angle is still at this point a former world's champion, that he kind of went down the ladder a little bit.
Yeah,
he into did kind of like instead of he didn't stay at the main event. Yeah. Like he would go up to the main event level. He'd go down the ladder a little bit. He'd go back up. And he was back down at this point. And Hulk Hogan's Hulk Hogan. So you've got this guy who just went back down to the mid card, who just lost a hair versus hair match against Edge, fighting the like you said, the just epitome of professional wrestling, like the biggest star ever, or second biggest star ever, depending on how you feel about Steve Austin. And it just kind of was just weird, but they made it work. Yeah. And they made it work in such a way that, you know, Hogan can have a good match for all the crap that he takes for not, you know, not being a technical masterpiece. You put him in there with a guy who can go, and he can go. Like, even at, you know, even 2002 Hulk Hogan could do that. And this match was just amazing. And I was not expecting the ending.
Yeah, and that ending was Hogan tapping out to the ankle lock. How big a deal was that? Because Hogan...
To me, that was huge.
Yeah, I mean, Hogan's not a guy who submits. I can't remember off the top of my head another time he lost by submission. He doesn't lose a lot, but I think definitely not by giving up.
I think it was when he dropped the WCW belt to Luger.
Yep.
The week before Road Wild. I think that was the only other time that I can think of off the top of my head.
I think he gave up to Sting, too, when he dropped the WCW title to Sting. But those weren't, like, iconic tap-outs. Those were just kind of throwaways. This was
an iconic tap-out.
Yeah, the highlight is him. He had enough time to try to get out of the ankle lock. He couldn't do it. It was not Hogan, you know, dragging us, kicking and screaming to him having to give up. It felt very natural, and it maybe should have done more for Angle than it did. I think it elevated him, and like you said, he kind of went up and down the ladder in WWE, never really got the chance to be permanently ensconced in the main event scene, partially because he was so good that he could work with anyone, that I think they trusted him to go up and down the card. But what a huge moment, what a reward for him getting the ankle lock tap out on Hulk Hogan.
When you consider Hulk Hogan's character throughout the 80s, the real American, tapping out to your American hero. Like, this was really more, this was a huge passing of the torch, I thought.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Watching the show, you know, it was really clear that it was just like, you know, you could tell that Hogan respected this guy.
Yeah,
it's hard not to, you know. And he didn't look like he was a guy who was upset that he was jobbing out.
No, he looked like he was having a blast getting in there with Angle. Angle was a little limited in this match in the sense that I don't think he could throw Hogan around with German suplexes.
Right.
Couldn't go full out. But you know what? Stuff like that, I think, makes for an even better match because it means you have to adapt. You have to work with the guy you're doing. And so it's even more impressive. It makes this match even more impressive. Probably my favorite match of the show.
Kurt Angle's a guy who can pretty much adapt against anybody, especially in 2002. You know, he is one of the best workers of that decade. So I'm not really surprised that he was able to figure it out. I'm surprised that it went as well as it did.
Yeah, it really did. We'll talk more about this at the end of the card, see how it levels up against the other really standout matches. But we go from guys who are really good in the ring to guys who are really good wrestlers but also happen to be pretty good at backstage stuff. That is Booker T and Goldust. We're having a really fun run as a tag team here, really fondly remembered, doing a lot of comedy stuff. Goldust in the back, dressed as The Rock. The Rock shows up. It's important because we needed to establish The Rock's being in the building. He will play a role later on in the main event. But he has a pretty fun interaction with Booker and Goldust. Goldust, to me, just steals the show with his motions, with his touching himself, and Rock getting on him on this. For three guys who, you know, could all go in the ring, what did you think of this kind of backstage distraction?
This is another example of a main event guy elevating some other people.
Hmm.
Because just putting, Booker T was a 5-time WCW champion, but in 2002, his stock was not very high.
No.
And, you know, teaming with Goldust, I think, is the perfect example of that. But you put him in a backstage segment with The Rock and just let the three of them have fun.
Hmm.
And these guys just, it was magic.
Yeah, absolutely. And from there, we head right back to the King of the Ring tournament. We were talking about it earlier. We covered the semifinals. Rob Van Dam got here by beating Chris Jericho. Brock Lesnar got here by beating Test. Both guys, highly valued, main event level talents. Brock, still a rookie, but clearly was headed for big things. Van Dam had been with the company about a year, very popular, very valued by people. Whereas in the first two semifinal matches, you had two very similar workers in Jericho and RVD, and then two power guys in Lesnar and Test. This was a styles clash, to be sure. It was a guy who could fly around the ring like Van Dam versus a pure brute power of Brock Lesnar. How do you think that made it? Did you enjoy the two styles playing off each other more than the matching up of the styles in the semifinals?
I thought that this match was better than I thought it would be. Mm-hmm. It was definitely better than I remember it being. I remember going into this match thinking that, you know, it was just going to be a complete and total Brock squash.
Yeah.
That they were going to sacrifice Rob Van Dam to the Beast. And that was it. But, you know, RVD held his own. I don't, like, probably, knowing what I know now, I doubt RVD would have let that happen. But yeah, he probably Brock's best match.
Really?
Coming up to this point.
Yeah. Definitely the first match where he really gets to show his stuff, really gets to work against someone who's in there to have a good match and not just have a squash. Do you think RVD was leading Brock through a good match? Do you think
probably
Brock at this point could take control? I don't know. I'm split. I think Brock is so natural in there and has enough of a personality that I don't know. I think they were probably working together on this.
Maybe, but you know, when you have Paul Heyman there with you,
yeah,
a guy who knows,
right? Let's not discount Heyman either. Yeah.
You know, you don't. I'm fairly certain that Heyman went to Brock Lesnar, let him lead you when you need it. Let him take the lead and let him bring you to what you need to do.
And it's interesting because RVD is not a guy, to quote from what you were doing earlier, when you called Jericho a ring general. I don't normally think of Van Damme as a ring general.
No, but I don't think that he's thought that way. But it doesn't surprise me to think of him for me. I think that he probably does it more than we expect. And especially when you have a guy who has been wrestling for, what was it at this point, 2-3 months?
Yeah.
You know, I think Rob Van Dam knows well enough of what he's doing to help lead a match. And I think that definitely Brock Lesnar would have trusted him, if anything, because Paul Heyman said to.
Yeah. Absolutely. Now, you said going into the night, you knew who was going to win. You thought it was that obvious that this was set up for Brock Lesnar to win?
Yes.
I agree with you. I don't think there was ever any question. This was a guy who King of the Ring was designed for. How much mileage do you think he got out of being King of the Ring? Was it something that another guy on the roster could have done better with, or was it just good, just give him the accolade, let him steamroll through here and go right on to the main event?
It was absolutely just a stepping stone.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it was, you know, he could have had a number one contenders match.
Sure.
And accomplished the same thing, but having two very different matches on this card really helped establish him with the fans against guys who have been around for a while, Test and RVD, helps establish him as a monster with the fans and just gives him the opportunity to be accepted in that main event level.
Absolutely. Were you looking at Brock Lesnar as a rookie by the end of the show, or had he already proven that he was a little something more?
I think even going into this show, it was like, this guy's got it. He doesn't act like a rookie. He doesn't. He wasn't in the ring. He wasn't green in the ring at all. Like, he looked crisp. He looked like he knew what he was doing.
Absolutely. I agree. And did you think at this point, again, 2-3 months in, this guy was ready to main event SummerSlam against whoever was going to end up being the Undisputed Champion?
You know, I think that I was looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Especially when you see who left the show with the title today.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was not the match that we got at SummerSlam.
Right.
So, you know, I think I was more excited for the main event of SummerSlam before I found out what it was.
Interesting. Very interesting. And that leaves us with one match to go. We crowned a King of the Ring in Brock Lesnar. We still need to figure out who's Undisputed Champion. At the time of this show, it was The Undertaker, who had won it from Hulk Hogan the month before. He was in a feud with Triple H, who had lost the title to Hogan 2 months earlier than that. These guys were actually supposed to wrestle originally at Judgment Day at Backlash. I don't know. They were supposed to wrestle at some point. I don't do Justin Rosero level note-taking, but I know these guys were supposed to wrestle, and it got pushed off. They got into the King of the Ring. They had met before. They would meet again. It was, for all the storylines and whatever was going on, Raw versus SmackDown, all that, these are pretty much just two guys who really wanted to be Undisputed Champion. And it was about as simple a storyline as you could get. I remember this match poorly. And when I watched it again yesterday, I thought it was pretty good. I thought it was pretty
really?
Okay. So I want to get your take. Yeah, because
I think this is going to be the first time that we disagree tonight.
All right. Well, I thought it was okay, but it was definitely not a classic. Does this match have a bad – does it leave a bad taste in your mouth?
It was boring to me.
Yeah.
It was very boring to me.
And I think that's kind of the consensus on the match. I think you're definitely in the majority here.
I mean, it just, considering the rest of the action that we got, just up and down the card from the opening match with RVD and Jericho to Lesnar and RVD the match before, it was a lot of high energy. And these guys, and Triple H and The Undertaker, just wrestled a very paint-by-numbers main event, WWE main event-style match
that's a good way to put it.
No energy whatsoever. I had to fight to keep myself awake watching this match.
Wow. So where do you think they lost you? They weren't trying enough? Was it too long? Do these guys not have a natural chemistry? Because they've had good matches.
Undertaker in 2002 should not be going 20 minutes with anybody. I don't care if he's in the ring with Kurt Angle, Triple H, anybody. 23 minutes is just ridiculous. He was not at his best at that point. He had not hit the career resurgence that he would when he was in the ring with Brock and doing those just ridiculously violent matches that he had with Lesnar. And I don't know that I was ever actually into the match, honestly. I can't really explain, like, what it was. It just did not work for me at all.
Now, you've been mentioning, you've been giving a lot of high marks to Heyman throughout the night. Heyman was on commentary for a little here, and I thought he definitely added to the match. Did you think he added anything?
Oh, Paul Heyman has been one of my favorite characters since I first laid eyes on him in, like, 88, 89, whatever it was when he was in the NWA. So I am probably one of the biggest Paul Heyman marks you will ever meet. So that draws me in. But the guys in the ring didn't do it. It was Paul on commentary.
There's one more factor to this match that we haven't talked about, and that's The Rock, who makes his presence known midway through, runs Heyman off, ends up interfering through the convolutedness of swinging a steel chair, missing Undertaker, hitting Triple H. Eventually, Rock does roundabout cost Triple H this match. Undertaker walks out of the match, still the champion, walks out of the pay-per-view, still the champion. Did you enjoy the stuff with The Rock, or did you think it was just piling more on a match that was already wearing your patience?
Oh, it was just piling on. It was just piling on. I love The Rock. I didn't care when he came in. I just 2002 Undertaker and Triple H are probably two of my least favorite guys. It doesn't help that if you look through between WrestleMania and SummerSlam, this is the only show where the WWE title didn't change hands. And it's kind of like that hot-shotting always bothered me because it just kind of took away from the value. And it was just an expectation that they were going to do it again when The Rock came out. They didn't, which is good, but it didn't help the match at all. It just dragged it out further and just made it worse somehow.
All right, well, let's not linger on this match. Let's try to have a positive memory of what we got to watch over the past week or so. Overall, Stephen, what would you say about the show? Thumbs up, thumbs down?
Definite thumbs up. Easy thumbs up.
Yeah, I thought it was a fun show. I would say my favorite match was Hogan and Angle. That was definitely the highlight for me. I liked the Cruiserweight match a lot, too. I thought those were both really good. What were some of your favorite moments of the show?
I really liked the Flair-Guerrero match. That was a lot of fun. Again, like you said, the Kurt Angle Hulk Hogan match was just off the charts. Paul Heyman bringing Brock Lesnar along for me was really great. I enjoyed that a lot, and that's probably the majority of what makes this a thumbs up show.
Cool. Well, guys, you can check this out if you have WWE Network or if, I don't know, you have the VHS or DVD. Feel free to try that out, too. But, you know, we watched King of the Ring 2002. I think we both pretty much enjoyed it. So, Stephen, how would you rate your Place to Be Nation podcast debut?
So this was a 10 out of 10. Easy.
Awesome, man. Do you have anything to plug?
Well, you know, I should be, you know, you mentioned that I did the WrestleMania Top 10 around WrestleMania season. I'm going to be going back into that with SummerSlam.
Oh, beautiful. I can't wait to read
starting
that.
Later this month. I need to give myself ample time
to watch
all 28 shows.
Something like that.
At this point, there's a lot of them. So that's what that's the best thing to look forward to. And should be also debuting a more of a comic book kind of geeky themed column over at Place to Be sometime soon.
Very cool. Well, we look for big things from you. Mr. Ferrari, we thank you for being on Place to Be Nation Rewind.
Gosh, thanks for having me, Ben. I really appreciated the opportunity. I had a lot of fun.
Absolutely. And, of course, we will be back with another great show next month. But until then, I'm Ben Moore. Be kind. Rewind.